This is a fun and challenging parsha, Parshat Mishpatim. One of the few parshiot are labeled for one of the first nouns, so to speak, or typical phrases, unique phrases that begin them. But this parasha, Mishpatim, although it's one of the second word of the parasha, is a parasha about Mishpatim, about ordinances, about civic ordinances. Is that a problem on the microphone or is that a problem outside? Do you hear that? Gotcha. Okay. And I think you could make the case that this is a parasha which is difficult for the Jewish people in Christian eyes because it makes us look like a people of the law exclusively. The first roughly five aliyot are dedicated to very particular ordinances. And yet those aliyot exist in tension with the latter aliyot, which are somewhat more narrative and spacious and uplifting into the supernal realms where Moses, Aaron, and the elders are invited by God to ascend and eat together. And what's called theestai, eating together with the divine. It's actually an old theme. But first, the particular. So we have this thing called lex talionis, which is the fancy word for eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, hand for a hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. But the basic law is you get what you did. You get what you pay for. A difficult and problematic law, even by our sages' understanding, because what if I knock out your eye, but I already have missing an eye? Or I cause you a bruise, but I already have that bruise. So how do we rectify that? And they understood it. They already understood it to be a system of compensation rather than retribution. Okay. But clearly a very, in some ways, let's say, dry, bare-bone, black-letter law. Then you get more interesting laws. I love this. First a side note. No, I'll tell the story. So we get the one about an ox that gores a person and the person dies, and then you have to stone the ox to death, and you can't eat the meat. Presumably, perhaps, because there was a sense of what you are what you eat, and if you consume something vicious, you yourself will become vicious. That's somewhat contained in some of the laws of kashrut, at least as understood by our later sages. But I also like a different interpretation. So you remember, where's the town where they executed the elephant? South of us? Irwin, right. So they hung an elephant. I was on a board with the lovely Annie Colquitt, who was quite brilliant. And I don't know how the subject came up about hanging the elephant. And we all decided, why did they hang the elephant? And she says, you got to do it in public, teach the other elephants a lesson. You hang the elephant, you kill the ox, you stone it in public to teach the other oxen a lesson. But contra our Christian brethren, who might view us with disdain as a purely legal tradition, which I think is a vast and problematic overstatement, even this parasha rides the tension between black letter law, between the bullet points, the jots and tittles of human experience and how justice must be done, and the broader question of principles of the law, the wisdom of the law, the narrative. There is a legal scholar, Dworkin, who wrote a famous piece called Nomos and Narrative, the tension between the narrative pieces of the law and the nomos literally being the law as we understand it on lines and papers. So we get that parasha. This is, you know, we get Ela Mishpatim, but also repeatedly, I think at least three times in this parasha, don't wrong a stranger, for you were strangers in Egypt. Don't wrong the widow and the orphan, for I will make you widows and orphans. So a broad scope that's got no particular definition that might be hard to uphold. So one of the messages I think we are being told, this may be a paraphrase from the wonderful show Better Call Saul, is that law is at its best, at its ideal, an approximation of justice. We all know that there can be miscarriages of justice, or at least misinterpretations and misuses of law, but that justice is something more supreme. which is not to say that law and justice don't overlap at all. But in our tradition, as in every tradition, law is merely an orientation towards justice or an approximation of justice. People could make other arguments, but I think that's a bit of what's being said. And so that gives us, as everywhere in the Jewish tradition, the ability to challenge. Just as much as we can challenge theologies about God and question certain beliefs, we can also challenge certain laws. They are not immutable and eternal and constant and writ in stone, but they have a context and a color and a spirit behind them. But some would still try to make them explicit law. So Maimonides in the Mishneh Torah says that if you wrong the convert, either fiscally or verbally, you're violating three prohibitions, meaning that these are specific laws, mitzvot, that you can violate and be held accountable for. And the Mishnah, some a millennium almost before Maimonides, gives you very specific ways to observe this idea of caring for the stranger, the refugee, the emigre, the widow, and the orphan. If someone was a repentant person, you don't recall their former sins. If someone is the child of converts, you don't say, remember your ancestors. You don't draw one's attention to certain things. That's a piece of respecting the stranger, the ger, which at various times has meant a convert, or a sojourner, or a resident alien, someone with a green card. More or less what we're talking about now. But there is this broader tension that still persists between law and justice, and the possibility in all ages, at all times, to blindly follow law and leadership, and to be, in an article I read recently in Psychology Today, an enabler of evil. Percentage of people who are sociopathological is 1% or 2% of the population. But the numbers of people who have enabled Bernie Madoff, Jim Jones, Jeffrey Epstein is legion. So I think that draws us to the bigger question of how much and how diligently and how period do we obey law? Cornel West, whatever your agreements or disagreements with his politics, said something in the last presidential campaign that I find genius. Justice is what love looks like in public. Justice is what love looks like in public. I couldn't agree more. So let's go down that hole, let's dig deeper into the question of the moral, spiritual, and evanescent context of law itself. So I've mentioned to you before that one of my favorite legal sources is the Sefer HaChinuch, a very early source that doesn't present itself as a law code in the same way that Maimonides and Jacob ben Asher and the Shulchan Aruch do. It presents itself more likely as an ethical treatise given from father to son or grandfather to grandson on a bar mitzvah. That's some of the speculation. But it does provide an early sensibility of the law embedded deeply in moral context. So here on this question of abusing the orphan and the widow, the Sefer HaChinuch is much more expansive. We are prevented from burdening them by action or speech, and all of a person's matters with them, ideally business matters, should be calm and with kindness and compassion. Good luck enforcing that in the court, right? You have that regular experience Jewishly that you can be what's called a naval birshut haTorah, you can be a heel within the permission of the Torah, and we're required to go, we say beyond the letter of the law, and Jewishly you say within the letter of the law, meaning to withhold our full rights, to take responsibility for others by not exacting the full course of the law on them. That's, I think, what the Sefer HaChinuch is suggesting. There's a moral component that's deeper or more profound or more expansive than what could ever be written in a book. And usually we fall prey to that a lot, and I think that might be part of the reason our Christian comrades would call us legalistic. It's because once we see it in a book, we point to it. We say, that's the halakha, that's the mitzvah. And The act of writing it down and publishing it is a much later experience than the act of living it actively and living it fully and Catholically, broadly in our lives. So again, in this cool parsha with a lot of details, it also has some interesting narrative moments. And we're reminded in chapter 23, towards the middle end, that we are following an angel, that God has appointed us an angel, and that we are to follow that angel, and that God's name is within that angel, to be our leader and emissary from God. As I was reading it again this week, it occurred to me, at first it sounds like it's describing Moses. There is, parenthetically, let's put this as an aside, there's always a tension in the tradition about Moses being semi-divine. It definitely gets resolved as non-divine, but there's always been a slight tension that Moses might be a demigod, a dangerous tradition. But that drew my mind, of course, to Lincoln and the better angels of our nature. Like, the law, if it's approximating justice, justice as love in public, and love and justice are always calling us to be our best selves. Just because you can commit a crime and get away with it, or just because something's not on the law books as a crime, doesn't mean you get to do it. And I think that undergirds the whole Jewish legal system, and of course, the American legal system. And so since Nuremberg, the defense I was just following orders is no defense at all. Right? We watch sociopaths, Jim Jones, the Moonies, cult leaders, religious leaders, political leaders who have cadres of sycophants and enablers, business leaders. And as was said, I just read who said this, I don't recall the quote, you know, that the only thing required for evil to flourish is for good persons to do nothing. So one of the broader cases is in discussing legal principle that you should not follow the majority to do wickedness. Meaning particularly in the Torah that in a case of a court, you know, 12 angry men, right? Just because 11 people on the jury say he's guilty, you still have to stand up for what you believe if you believe they're in the wrong. So Bachia, late medieval sage, Jack, 12th century-ish. I was a bad history student and I'm terrible at geography. That the plain meaning of this words is that if you see a vast majority of people acting in a forbidden manner, don't make the fact that they constitute the norm an excuse to follow in their footsteps. It's just so easy. It's not really collapsing to peer pressure as much as seeing things as they are, understanding the norm, which is to say the middle of a bell curve of human behavior, as the right, and finding yourself possibly on the wrong side of history. That you, a Jew, a human being, was intended to be at one periphery of that bell curve so that you can bend the arc of history toward justice. And that blindly following, to circle back to Rabbi Bach's argument last night, sort of an anti-refugee, anti-immigrant rhetoric, to be blindly following the anger of the masses, to be blindly following us and them rhetoric, which we are hearing on all sides, is no kind of justice. And the Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, said on this verse about following the majority to wickedness, if, in your opinion, the majority are about to commit an error, don't remain silent because they are the majority, but state your view. This applies even if you know beforehand that they won't accept your viewpoint. Upstanders, not bystanders. Defenders, not enablers. Not blindly following the law, but understanding that the law is a vehicle and a vessel through which we achieve justice, and that justice is neither clear nor straight nor evident, and that laws sometimes need to change, and that in this season of election, leadership isn't about defining and codifying things as they are, but speaking, as Bobby Kennedy would have said, as things as they might be.